I still had a bunch of unanswered questions. I run into them all the time. One of the problems about being an idealist is you spend most of your time being frustrated. I got that. Lesson learned. That didn't mean I had to like it. Simon had to have habits, just like everyone else roughly classified as human. There were places he felt comfortable in, and places he didn't. Being on the hunt, he would most likely choose somewhere he felt safe. All I had to do was find out where. I checked a couple of what I thought could be spots Simon would frequent with no luck. As far as I could tell, he had dug a nice deep hole and pulled the earth in after him. By the time the sun went down, my dogs were whimpering for relief. Paddy's was too far away, so I checked in at the Somersault. Tommy Chang smiled at me as I pushed through the bar's door.
Evening, Mr. Mandolin. What can I get you?
A beer, a burger, and some friendly conversation, Tommy. In that order will do just fine. I sank gratefully onto a stool. Tommy slid a coaster to a neat stop in front of me as he reached for a glass.
The usual, Mr. Mandolin?
Is there anything else? I looked around the bar as he poured. Lucchesi's dealings with Rorsch had only improved the atmosphere. Fats and his crowd were nowhere to be seen. They had been replaced with faces I didn't know, which was just fine with me. That meant I didn't have to concentrate on watching my back as I ate. I know I'm a cynical bastard, but being mobile and upright does have its benefits.
Here you are, Mr. Mandolin. Your burger will be done shortly. Fries okay?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Tommy. How are things going since...
They've been just fine. I don't know what you did or said, Mr. Mandolin, but I've been left alone ever since. I'm sorry I called you a son of a bitch.
Call him like you see him, Tommy. That's always the best way. Son of a bitch is one of my most redeeming virtues. With that first sip, I found myself enjoying the feeling of being off the street. By the way, I'm looking for this fella. Fedora? Scarf? Kinda looks like Claude Rains. Ring any bells?
I remember a guy kind of like that talking about his place just off the Haight. He said he had one of those houses that look onto the panhandle section of the park. I remember that because he was pleased how the property value kept climbing.
Oh, this could help, Tommy. When did he tell you this?
Couple of weeks ago. You sure this could help?
It could indeed. Thanks. The panhandle of Golden Gate Park extended off the main body of the park east for a few blocks between Oak and Fell Streets. If Simon's house looked onto the panhandle, it had to be one of those facing north, which meant it faced Oak Street. No wonder Simon was pleased. Anyone owning one of those properties was sitting on a gold mine. Checking out the panhandle neighborhood could prove useful. A predator type like Simon was usually pretty attached to his roots, perhaps more so than others. The parkland between Oak and Fell would give me ample cover to sit and watch without being too obvious. It occurred to me that Simon never mentioned a last name. That could put a hitch in finding out which of the dozen or more houses belonged to him. I was going to have to call Driver again. His family owned most of that land through various affiliates. If I could get access to those records, it would save me a lot of footwork and considerably more door knocking. By the time I left the Somersault, I was ready for bed. Finding electrolyte-loving serial killer vampires was going to have to wait for another day. I grabbed the bus and rode it to the closest stop. The air held that particular salt crispiness common to San Francisco. Usually invigorating, the stress of the last few days was a match even for the night air of the city. My dogs were dragging, my ass was dragging, and even my... I felt fragments of brick pepper my coat as I dove for the shelter of a parked car. A second shot took out one of the car's windows. Shattered safety glass showered down across my shoulders. I crawled my way over to the rear bumper and peered around it. Another bullet spanged off the fender, sending me back behind the car.
How do you feel now, Mandolin? Think you'll be a big man with a bullet hole in you?
Rorsch. So the creep somehow survived. Schultz must be getting soft.
I'm doing just fine, Wally. How's the job prospects?
I slithered backwards behind the rear fender.
Your shooting hasn't improved any more than your looks, Rorsch. That one missed me by a mile.
What? Oh, of course, I wanted to make him angrier. Was he going to try to do something worse than kill me? Two more bullets tore out some of the masonry behind me. I began wondering how large a clip he was holding. What I didn't wonder about was the lack of police response. They would probably park at the corner and take bets on how long Mama Mandolin's baby boy lasted.
You're mine, Mandolin! I own you, you interfering crud!
I didn't reply. I was too busy working on how to get myself out of target range. Another bullet ricocheted off the bricks. Rorsch must have a night scope, but he couldn't be on a roof, otherwise I would have already been perforated.
What's the matter, Mandolin? Where's that smart mouth of yours now?
Headlights appeared at the corner. A step van was coming onto the street. If it didn't speed up too much, I might have a chance to get out of this alive. The van downshifted. I got ready, and as soon as the van came alongside the car, I started running. The slope of the street was steep enough to keep the van from accelerating too quickly. My legs would complain about the uphill sprint later. They could debate the issue with my hide, free from unplanned holes. An alley cut through the block to Fell Street on the other side. I pelted down it until I reached the backside of my apartment building. A dumpster sat below the bottom rung of the fire escape. Climbing onto the dumpster, I was able to reach the fire escape ladder. The first window was locked, but the second opened, and I climbed in. If Rorsch knew enough about me to ambush me outside my apartment building, he probably knew which apartment was mine. Rorsch was no genius, but he had to guess that I wouldn't stay on the street with him shooting at me. I probably had only minutes before he reached my apartment. I doubted he would ring the doorbell. The first thing I did after opening the door was to check my old Colt revolver. The next thing was to go back into the corridor. I was no genius either, but I certainly knew more about tactics than Rorsch. He'd expect me to try to hide in the apartment. The last thing he'd expect was to be ambushed. A small foyer leading to a restroom opened onto the corridor. From it, I could see the opening to the stairs, the elevator, and the window leading to the fire escape. It was a good bet Rorsch would leave the elevator alone, too vulnerable to attack. For the same reason he would choose the stairs over the fire escape. I didn't need the stigma of being a cop killer, not even a disgraced one like Rorsch, not in this town. Trying my high dive technique off the Golden Gate would have better prospects as far as my future was concerned. That ruled out pulling the trigger as soon as I saw Rorsch's ugly puss come out of the stairwell. I was going to have to rely on his lack of courage and his belief that everyone was as socially challenged as he was. In essence, I was going to have to arrest him. Rorsch tiptoed out of the stairwell, holding the rifle in front of him just like the SWAT boys do. My guess had been right on target. It was a night scope. He swung the barrel of the rifle back and forth, making sure of a quick shot if something, namely me, moved into his line of fire. I tensed. Rorsch was going to have to pass right by my hiding place in order to reach my door. My best hope lay in his not pivoting to check the restroom before swinging around to my door. Lady Luck is a fickle broad at best. I grabbed the muzzle of the rifle as he checked the foyer to the restroom. It was a semi-auto copy of an M16, and he got off three shots into the ceiling before I jammed the barrel of the Colt into his neck. Over the scent of carbide, I smelled booze. Rorsch had been fortifying his store of courage with the liquid variety before setting out on his mandolin hunt.
What a surprise! It's my old friend Walter Rorsch come to visit, and he brought a present as well.
You son of a bitch!
I pushed the revolver a little deeper into his neck.
Now, let's have none of that. This is a family building, you know.
I yanked the rifle out of his grasp and held it up to the dim corridor light.
I'll bet you don't have an official requisition form for this beauty, do you?
You're gonna have to kill me, Mandolin.
The pressure I was putting on the Colt had his head tilted back as far as it would go. You have no idea how much I wanted to pull that trigger.
If you don't, I'm gonna hunt you down and finish the job.
Well, we can't have that now, can we?
His eyes went wide, waiting for the shock of the bullet scrambling his brains. I pulled the Colt out from under his jaw and slammed it down onto his head as hard as I could. He went down and stayed down.
I guess you'll just have to write me love letters from prison, then.
Monahan sent over a cruiser to collect Rorsch. The uniformed officers who made the call must have been new on the force. They were actually civil to me. They also took the M16 copy and several snapshots of the building and the Swiss cheesed car. I gave them my card, along with a promise that I would check in with Monahan later to feed him the details of my encounter. Rorsch had a lot to say to me as he was dragged away. None of it family-oriented. Then I collapsed onto my bed and remained comatose until noon. Breakfast consisted of what little I could find in the fridge that was worthy of frying and a pot of coffee. I decided it might also be a good idea to shower the last of yesterday's adventures away and greet the city as a human being. The shower helped a lot. After I dressed, I called Driver. There was no answer. Not even his secretary picked up, so I left a message and hit the street. I also added a few of my favorite equalizers, including my Colt, to my wardrobe, and headed to the Panhandle. The Panhandle began at Baker, so that's where I got off. It was nearing 3 in the afternoon, so I decided to shop for information on Simon's habits from a few of his neighbors in the Hate. Little had changed from its heyday in the 60s. The street still held a mix of tourists, street people, and the occasional suit. I checked in a few shops, but came up with nothing. Sometimes it took a little work to get people on your side here. Neighborhoods in San Francisco can be like that. Small town attitudes secreted away in the big city. The stranger has to prove himself even to get the time of day. A check with Driver's phone still produced nothing, and I was beginning to wonder if I should check with Lucchesi for records. Shaking my head at my own notion, I wandered into the coffee house across the street from the ice cream parlor. It gave me a good view of the row of houses, and besides that, I was getting hungry. A stakeout takes time, patience, and a place to be comfortable, so I settled down with a slice of pie and a cup and waited. 3 slices and 4 cups later, I got lucky. As the sunset was beginning to paint the clouds, Simon strolled into the ice cream parlor. Having gotten an up-close and personal look at his fashion sense, the guy stood out in a crowd. There just aren't that many people with multi-$1,000 wardrobes. He was wearing his fedora and a scarf draped over his coat. From my vantage point across the street, I could watch the activity at the parlor's counter. Simon bought his ice cream cone and left the parlor, heading west toward the park. It was at that time of day when things are the dimmest along the city's streets. Too early for the streetlights to come on, too late for the sun to be any help. There were still plenty of people on the sidewalks, so I left a tip and joined them. Unlike Simon, I don't stand out in a crowd, which is good for someone in my line of work. I stayed on my side of the street and shadowed Simon as he ate his cone and window shopped between licks. When he got to the intersection of Haight and Masonic, I jaywalked and blended into the crowd a couple of doors behind him as he headed north. I could see the border of the park coming up. A couple of the streetlights flickered and then stayed on. The rest would follow in a couple of minutes. That helped a bit as long as he stayed on the streets. But if he decided to cut through the park, that was another matter. Dark clothes, dark park, you figure it out. A city bus blocked my view as Simon crossed over to the park. He must have spotted me somehow, because when the bus took off, so did he. For a man in wingtips, he could move. After the bus pulled away, I only got a glimpse of flapping overcoat as he sprinted into the rhododendrons. The bushes closed over him, and then he was gone. But I wasn't going to let a little thing like umpteen acres of pitch-black wooded parkland keep me from getting the answer to that nagging question. I legged it into the park. Scents of night blooms and mown grass greeted me as I followed Simon through the brush. Once I made it past the rhododendrons, it became a little easier to see. The lights of the park shone onto the path as it wound its way through and around the cypress and gum trees. Off to the left, and about 40 yards ahead of me, was Simon, still picking them and putting them down as quickly as he could, which was way better than my usual speed. Because he kept the paths, I was able to keep him in sight. He crossed Fell, turned onto Ashbury, and then headed downhill. I made the mistake of trying to catch up and took a header that landed me upside down in the gutter. The last thing I saw of Simon was him looking over his shoulder at me as he turned the corner. I think he was smiling at me. I limped my way back through the park and caught a bus back to the apartment. When the phone rang, I was cleaning off my assorted scrapes and bruises. If this was how Monahan earned his pay, he could keep it.
What?
Have I called it a bad time, Mr. Mandolin?
Driver? Right now there wouldn't be a good time. What do you want?
If you will recall our last conversation, I told you I would be fulfilling my part of our agreement, the payment of your fee.
Oh, well, I appreciate that, Mr. Driver, but I don't feel that I deserve it.
What was I saying? It felt like I was listening to someone else speak with my voice, and I couldn't stop him.
The money has already been deposited, Mr. Mandolin. I won't miss it.
I'm going to find him.
I have no doubt of that at all, Mr. Mandolin. Good night.
Wait, Mr. Driver, I have a question.
Ask, Mr. Mandolin.
So, I asked. It turned out he did have the ability to get me access to ownership records for the Panhandle neighborhood. I set an appointment for tomorrow and put the phone down and went to bed.
Ah, you were close, Mr. Mandolin. Just not close enough.
Simon?
Correct, Mr. Mandolin. As per the conditions of our contest, you will find a clue at the edge of the park where you last saw me. Happy hunting.
Where are you, Simon?
Oh, come now, Mr. Mandolin. Do you really expect me to answer such a question? Now, do your part. There's the body of a delightfully fresh jogger awaiting. She tasted like melon with a hint of currant and raspberry.
Why, Simon? Why the game?
Aye, there's the rub.
What?
Shakespeare, Mr. Mandolin. One of the greatest ignored philosophers mankind has ever known.
Huh?
Oh, you really do need to broaden your reading material, Mr. Mandolin. Try some of the classics. Now, to the park! Time is wasting.
I put the receiver down and then remembered. I was home. My office phone was listed. My home number was not. Even though it was pretty early, Pat was already in his office. Guess the whole killer on the loose thing had him working overtime. He was as cheery as ever when I called.
Morning, Pat.
What is it now, Mandolin? Can you ever accept decent advice when it's given to you?
Thanks, Monahan. You're one of my favorite people, too. I want to take you up on that sketch artist offer.
Good, good. Give me a time and I'll make the arrangements.
Have you found out anything?
Nah, I thought I'd just sit here and wait for the clues to come to me.
Hey, I didn't do the killings, remember? I'm the guy who's come the closest to the killer. When you get the message, just ignore it. I got another call last night. He claims there's a clue at the park where I first saw him. He also says he killed another one.
What? Gah! Sorry, Mandolin. I'm a little short-tempered. The mayor's been all over the department. Unfortunately, your name's been tossed about, which hasn't done much for your reputation around here.
I didn't do anything.
Yes, you did. You found the guy. The mayor's been riding the chief hard because a worn-out PI did what the entire department couldn't, and you know what sort of stuff runs downhill.
So, instead of being grateful, the department has decided I've insulted them yet again.
No one ever said bureaucracy was fair, Mandolin, just incredibly effective at ensuring job security. It's like a union on steroids.
Look, Monahan, I think I know where he's going to be tonight. He says there's a clue in the park, but it's going to be tricky catching him.
Oh, yeah?
Like I said, he called just before I called you.
Okay, Mandolin. Here's what we're gonna do.
I caught a bus to the Presidio at 9 o'clock. Huge, ancient cypress trees dotted the landscape and added their fragrance to the evening air. As the sun climbed into the sky, a coastal fog drifted inland, bringing with it a rapid drop in temperature. I pulled up the collar of my coat and stuck my hands into its pockets. As I mooched along the path, I kept an eye out for any form that roughly resembled Simon or a cop. At Fort Point, I climbed the stairs that took me onto the pedestrian path of the bridge. Because of the fog, the crowd was a lot thinner than normal. I could walk along the northbound side without anyone jostling me. Following the path I remembered taking as I chased Simon last night, I kept my gaze on the ground, searching for that clue Simon had mentioned. I got ready to push through the rhododendrons, not knowing what, if anything, I'd find on the other side of them.
Why, hello, lover.
I turned, and there was Frankie, headed toward me under full steam. He had on what looked like silk or satin brocade pajamas with one of his shocking pink boas. A floppy, oversized beret was draped down over one eyebrow and partially supported by a pair of the most garish sunglasses I'd ever laid eyes on.
Frankie, what the hell are you doing here?
Ooh, is that any way to greet an old friend? I just happened to be shopping in the Hate and, well, anyway, how do you like my new ensemble?
Isn't that look a bit masculine for you?
Well, I thought it was time for a change. Whoever said girls had more fun didn't know what the hell they were talking about.
Frankie, I've got work to do.
Ooh, you're on a case? Can I help?
I don't know, Frankie. This one's pretty dangerous.
Danger. Mm. On the case with Tony Mandolin. Wait. The name's Bond. Frank Bond.
Frankie, people have died. You could die.
In this outfit? Oh, please be serious.
I am serious.
Frankie took on a stubborn look as he planted both ham-sized hands on his hips.
I am not going away, Tony. Now, I don't care if you are chasing down Al Capone, the Mexican cartel, or Dracula. I am here for the duration.
Frankie had no idea how accurate his sarcasm was. We spent a good long moment staring at each other.
All right, but keep your eyes open.
Right. What are we looking for?
I don't know. Just keep your eyes open and stay out of trouble.
I pushed through the rhododendrons. Frankie followed me.
Really? Someone got up on the wrong side of the bed.
I tried to concentrate on the ground. I saw no footprints. Nothing.
Tony! Is this a clue?
Huh?
Over here! Is this a trail of breadcrumbs? This is just like Hansel and Gretel out of the Brothers Grimm.
At least the grim part. I moved over to where Frankie stood and looked at the ground where he pointed. He was right. A line of breadcrumbs stretched away from the base of the cypress next to where we stood. Up ahead, some of the park's chipmunks and squirrels were busy eliminating the evidence.
Stay behind me, Frankie.
I jogged along the line of breadcrumbs. It snaked along the grass, winding from tree to tree until it came to another copse of roadies. This patch was one of the thick ones and loaded with blooms. The smell already told me what I'd find inside. Frankie caught it and slapped a perfumed hanky over his mouth.
My heavens! Oh! What is that awful stench?
I looked over my shoulder.
My clue.
I pushed through the bushes and looked at the body lying on the bare ground underneath the leaves. It was another redhead. She lay face down, one arm crossed under her head, the other stretched along her side. I didn't have to bend down to see inside of that arm. Simon's calling card stood out like a beacon. Frankie pushed through the bushes.
Oh, my dear Lord.
He had nothing to do with this.
Look around. There'll probably be something else here that seems out of place. Frankie nodded, still holding his flower-scented filter in place, and began poking around under the bushes. I knelt down to turn Simon's latest victim over.
Damn, and hell.
Tony, is this another clue?
I turned to look. Frankie, bent nearly in half, was pointing at a piece of rolled-up paper tied to a branch with a piece of green ribbon.
Yes, that would be a clue. Go ahead, hand it to me.
I unrolled the mini-scroll. A monogrammed S in embossed emerald ink stood out at the top center of the paper. He may have been a monster, but Simon had brass. Underneath the monogram, a note addressed to me was written in a nice round hand script.
Mr. Mandolin, if you are reading this rather than the police, I congratulate you on your ability to follow simple instructions. You have managed to win your way to the next level of our contest. This snack was particularly unsatisfying, so I will seek richer fare. Look for me in a new hunting ground. It is a cozy community west of a place named for a particular tree with a glandular problem. Mr. Graham would have liked it. Simon.
Damn.
Problem, Tony?
I stuffed the note into my pocket.
Just the usual nightmare. Let's go.
We pushed through the rhododendron copse and headed back towards Pacific Avenue. Simon was taunting me as he killed another innocent. There was an obvious clue pointing toward his next victim in the note, but I had no idea who this Graham was and what glandular problems had to do with trees. Frankie walked along with me, his considerably longer legs easily keeping pace. He kept quiet as we walked. Either he was shaken by our find or he was giving me some space. Either way, I was grateful. We crossed Pacific and continued south to Jackson. I planned on grabbing a bus on Jackson and heading back to my office. I thought better in grubby, familiar surroundings. As we approached the corner of Jackson and Walnut, Frankie nudged my shoulder.
Look out, Tony. It's Mumbling John.
I looked up. Coming toward us was what looked like an animated mulch pile. The coloring was an overall melange of gray, brown, and green. A tattered fedora was pulled down tightly onto a head covered with matted hair that included a good percentage of dirt and leaves. The mass of hair blended into an equally picturesque beard that stuck out in all directions. Mumbling John walked in a sort of penguin-like waddle as if he had feet but no legs. He came within a few feet of us and stopped, swaying slightly. He never actually stood still. He stuck his hand out, palm up.
Brother can his bear die?
Oh, he wants some money.
I figured that one out for myself.
I dropped a couple of quarters into the outstretched palm. I was careful not to touch anything, but I firmly believed in keeping potential sources of info well-greased, no matter how remote. The offering disappeared into the mulch. Mumbling John stood there, swaying. Then he shuffled toward where Frankie and I stood. We judiciously stepped to either side and watched him pass.
Motherfucker going by Woodside. Run faster. Save a girl.
I had to hold my breath as John passed. The odor of Simon's last victim was pleasant compared to the accumulated scents wafting around John. Frankie and I started walking toward the bus stop again.
Oh, sir?
I turned, surprised. Mumbling John stood staring at us, his eyes showing white all around.
Oh, sir!
Unnerved, I nodded and walked a bit faster toward the bus stop. Frankie had to hurry a bit to keep up. Once we were on the bus, Frankie tapped me on the knee.
What was that all about?
I'm not sure, but I think Mumbling John tried to give me a clue.
A clue? Mumbling John.
What did he say? Something about running faster?
Save a girl. Now, I distinctly heard save a girl.
Do you remember anything else Mumbling John said? It was more than just running faster and saving a girl. I thought I heard him mention a place.
He used his favorite cuss word.
Not that.
It was something... Bite her. He said, bite her. I'm sure of it. Right then, a place came to mind. Woodside. Mumbling John's diction would never win a debate, but he'd been, for him, crystal clear on this one. Woodside. That's the clue. It's got to be.
Redwood City. That has to be the tree with a glandular problem. Sequoia dendron giganteum. The giant sequoia. Ooh, my, isn't our killer the clever Dick?
Mm-mm-mm, not Dick. Vampire. A vampire that leaves wounds just like the one you saw back in the park.
Oh.
Frankie sat back against his seat.
Oh.
Monahan chewed me a new one for not phoning in the body Frankie and I found as soon as we'd stumbled across it. It didn't help when I reminded him I had no cell phone. I've never owned one, and don't plan to. If you want me, write a letter or drop by. I also told him about the note.
I want that evidence, Mandolin. It should have been left at the scene.
Well, I've got it now, and it says the same guy I told you about did this one too, and he gives us a clue about where the next one is going to be killed.
You'd better get down here right away and get that sketch done.
Frankie insisted on accompanying me to the station. The typical unfriendly stares came with an added smirk as we passed through the floors to Monahan's office. Frankie preened the entire way. I could feel the heat building up in my cheeks. Monahan was never gonna let me live this one down. I just knew it. He waved us in as we walked through the door onto the major crimes floor.
Bitch.
Monahan came from around his desk as we reached his office door. I handed over the note and waited as Monahan read through the note and then read through it again, his lips moving in concentration.
Mr. Mandolin, I congratulate you on your ability to follow simple instructions. You have managed to win your way to the next level of our contest. Look for me on a new hunting ground. It is a cozy community west of a place named for a particular tree with a glandular problem. Mr. Graham would have liked it. Simon. Glandular problem? Who the hell is Mr. Graham?
Sequoia dendron giganteum. The giant sequoia. It's a form of redwood.
Who the hell are you?
I am Franklin Amadeus Jackson. At your service.
What? Amadeus?
Mm-hmm. My parents had musical aspirations for me. La, 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 la.
All right, sit down.
Pat turned on a heel, stepped behind his desk, and dropped into his chair. As we sat, he waved the note in the air.
You two seem to have figured this thing out. So tell me, what does this mean?
It's all part of Simon's game, Pat. He left that next to his victim both as a taunt and as a clue. You can see the first part right there in the beginning of the note. The second points to Woodside, to the west of Redwood City.
I know where Woodside is. I also know it's far too large of an area to effectively stake out, and I can't just send Metro Police into someone else's jurisdiction. There's gotta be something.
Well, how about that sketch? If you knew what he looked like...
Right. This way.
Slapping both hands onto his desktop, he pushed himself upright and speed-walked out of the office. Frankie and I hurried to keep up. The police sketch artist didn't even bother looking up at us as Monahan told him what he wanted. All he did was ask the occasional leading question and then adjust the picture on his computer screen as necessary. It didn't take too long. Simon's face was a fixture in my memory.
I know that person.
What?
I know him.
How?
I'll ask the questions, Mandolin. All right, Jackson. Who is this guy and where can I find him?
Well...
Where?
Frankie recoiled slightly, even though he outmassed Monahan by at least 100 pounds and a foot in height.
Oh, really? Some people.
Where do you know him from?
The club.
Frankie just looked down at his shoes. Pretty sure he means the stud.
Oh, God.
He comes in on a fairly regular basis, and his name is not Simon. It's Marco. Oh, and he's got a lovely tush.
Pervert as well as a serial killer. Lovely.
Really? I never!
How often does he show up?
I don't know. I really didn't pay all that much attention. Wait. Thursdays. I remember. Oh, He always showed up on Thursday. See, that is when that little bitch Sammy does his Cher impersonation.
Okay, Thursday we stake out this club and hope we get lucky.
Oh, do I get to help?
Monahan can have a pretty ugly smile when he wants one.
Yes, indeed.
No, Tony! This is humiliating! This outfit does not suit me at all. There's not even one spot of color. That detective friend of yours is doing this just to be mean.
Huh. Camouflage, Frankie. Remember, we don't want to take a chance on Simon or Marco, whoever he is, recognizing you, especially if he's seen you talking to me. I handed Frankie a cap. Fortunately, the police had an officer near Frankie's size.
But a patrolman's uniform? Oh, come on now. The color does nothing for my complexion. Look at what the cut does to my hips, and just look at those shoes.
He gestured toward the massive black brogues covering his feet.
No style! No style at all!
Don't get your dainties in a twist.
Monahan came into the locker room carrying a small aluminum case.
This is a wireless mic and camera. The camera doubles as a tie pin and the mic hides under the badge.
And you're wiring my large identity-challenged friend because...
Because he will know who and what is going into and out of that club better than any of the officers currently in Metro and in this getup. All they'll see is yet another overly large minority San Francisco beat cop.
Ugh, I will never live this down. I just know it.
Now remember this. If you see this Marco, don't react other than tipping your hat. As far as anyone is concerned, you're nothing more than a friendly neighborhood beat cop. Got that?
Yes, sir, detective. Testing. 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing.
Will you tell him to knock that off?
You tell him. We were stuck into one of those high-tech surveillance vans. Yes, the cops really do have them. Frankie's voice came over one of the speakers as the view from his tie camera wavered on a couple of the monitors.
Testing! 1, 2, 3. There he is.
Where? All right, Jackson. Turn to face the perp. We need a positive ID.
Right! This will teach that scene stealer.
What?
There. There. There he is. That little egotistical bitch.
Frankie's hidden camera swung around to center on a tall, thin fellow with a shiny black overcoat draped over his shoulders as if it was a cape. A hideously garish green scarf was wrapped around his neck, and a wide-brimmed fedora completed the picture by being tipped down over one eye.
Is that him?
I felt doom rise up in my gut. No, that's Frankie's competition.
He is no competition. His version of Cleopatra would send Mark Antony screaming all the way back to Rome.
Jackson, focus. We are after a serial killer, not an actor.
But I...
You're supposed to be a beat cop. Try to act like one.
Frankie, think of this as a role. Think T.J. Hooker.
T.J. Hooker? This freak pronounces Cleopatra using 5 syllables, and you're gonna give him William Shatner as a role model?
That's all I could think of. One of the monitors showed us a street view of the club's storefront. We could see Frankie in his cop costume, hands clasped behind his back, walking back and forth on the sidewalk to the left of the club's entrance. The normal ebb and flow of Soma pedestrian traffic moved around him. Some of the passers-by ebbed into the club's front door, and some of them flowed right on by. A few noticed the ersatz cop and slunk away with guilty conscience written all over their expressions.
Good evening, citizen. Lovely weather. We're having night.
Frankie buried himself into the role, tipping his hat and strolling up and down the street in front of the stud.
What's that voice he's using?
His version of Shatner.
Sounds like he's constipated. Who's that he's talking to?
Oh, God. Frankie was striking up a conversation with the stage manager who had cut me in his dressing room. Pat, this doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere.
Patience, Mandolin. Sometimes these things can take days.
That's what I'm afraid of. Eventually, the foot traffic thinned out to the point where Frankie was the only one occupying the sidewalk besides the club's doorman. We watched the lack of activity until the club began to empty. No joy there. If Simon had showed up, he did so without using the front door.
Are we done here?
Wait a bit.
I've waited for hours.
I'm with Tony.
All right. Jackson, walk around the block. We'll pick you up on Norfolk, okay?
I had Monahan drop me off close enough to my apartment that I only had to trudge a couple of blocks to make it home. Literally trembling with exhaustion, I didn't bother flicking on the lights. Knowing the layout of my place as well as my tongue knew the inside of my mouth, I pulled off my coat and hung it onto the hook next to the door. My bedroom, that blessed paradise, occupied the far corner of the apartment just to the right of the kitchenette. I turned, locking onto the slightly ajar door, and began shuffling past the kitchenette towards paradise.
You failed to respond to my clue, Mr. Mandolin.
Adrenaline shoved my fatigue into a closet and slammed the door. Simon? Or is it Marco?
Very good, Mr. Mandolin. But you still have to pay the price for not fulfilling your part in our little competition. I was where I said I would be. You were not.
Aha! You mean Woodside? I had that figured out as soon as I found your note. As riddles go, it was pretty weak.
You're cleverer than I thought. Yes, it seems our contest is ending at just the right time.
Right. Let's see if you can handle being shot. I had his location now. He was in the living room, near the corner where I kept the bookcase. I was closer to the kitchenette, and a couple of chairs and a table were between Simon and the counter, and as a consequence, me. I sidled toward the counter in the kitchenette.
Have you forgotten how quickly I can move, Mr. Mandolin? You having a gun poses no danger to me.
Maybe, maybe not. Are you willing to take the chance? I eased open the top left-hand drawer under the countertop and felt with my fingertips for the butcher knife kept there. Well?
It seems I have overestimated you, Mr. Mandolin. This game no longer amuses me.
I pulled the knife out of the drawer as quietly as I could. I didn't say anything else, hoping the interior of my apartment was as dim to Simon as it was to me. Straining my eyes, I tried to focus on where I thought Simon stood. It could have been my imagination, but it looked like a slightly darker shadow was overlaid against the cheap wallpaper of my living room. There was a sense of movement. My head swam, and then I was bouncing off the door of my refrigerator. A sickeningly sweet smell mixed with that of rotting meat came to my nose. The refrigerator door opened, spilling light into the kitchenette. Simon stood over me, his right palm covered in blood, held open before his stomach. He was looking in disbelief at the knife hilt sticking out of his chest. Some of the fridge's contents fell to the floor.
Ow!
Simon continued to stare at the knife in his chest. I started to pick myself off the floor, only to be slammed back with bruising force. I felt my spine creak. The knife hit the floor.
No more games, Mr. Mandolin.
The smell was almost strong enough to gag me. I looked up and found out why. Simon's face writhed, its flesh twitching as it transformed. The jaw unhinged like that of a snake, and his tongue swelled as it extended out of his mouth. The tentacles I saw before started to sprout, waving as if they had a life of their own. Saliva, thick and ropey, began to build and dribble out of the mouth.
Time for dinner, Mr. Mandolin.
That hideous mouth bent closer. Panicked, I strained against the hand pushing me against the floor. No dice. Simon was inhumanly strong. As I strained, my right hand scrabbled around for the knife, but it was out of reach. I grabbed the first option available to me, a glass jar, and smashed it against the side of Simon's face. Simon arched back. The entire left side of his face boiled and smoked as if the jar had contained virulent acid rather than the pickles I smelled. I could see the white of bone showing through the bubbles. With the vampire no longer holding me down, I could move and did so, snatching up the knife and backing away. Simon, both hands held against his face, staggered back into the living room. He ran into my couch and threw it aside hard enough to bounce it off the wall. Reaching one of the windows, he grabbed a curtain and tore it free, using the fabric as a towel. Dropping the towel, Simon turned to look at me. The light from the open refrigerator showed me the damage my lucky shot had done. A good portion of the left side of his face was exposed bone. The rest showed as raw, red-latticed tissue.
Bastard!
Stay back! I have a jar of capers and I'm not afraid to use it!
Yeah, well, it didn't sound so ridiculous to me at the time. You had to be there, I guess.
This isn't over.
He turned and hurled himself out through the glass. I looked around the apartment.
I knew I should have taken out renter's insurance.
A jar of pickles?
Yes.
It tried to feed off you?
Yes.
Pickles?
Yes. Damn it, Paul, this really happened. I've got a hole through my bedroom window and a dent in my wall as proof. I smashed a jar of pickles against its face, and the stuff boiled away at the skin like it was hot acid.
Well, it was acid.
What?
Vinegar is the base material in most pickling solutions. On its own, the pH level can be as low as 2.4 or as high as 3.4. The higher the number, the less the level of acidity. Stomach acid has a pH level of 1, and hydrochloric acid sits at a level 1/10 of that. Your jar of pickles was, in fact, a jar of acid, so to speak.
Hydrochloric acid, I can understand, but this was vinegar, Paul. Why would a jar of pickle juice boil away skin and muscle to the bone?
A good question. What would cause skin, which normally has a pH of 4.5 to 6, react to a liquid with a pH no lower than 2.4, as if its pH was considerably lower?
Would what it eats be a factor?
Possibly. What does it eat again?
Electrolytes, remember? You said that all of the victims had been drained of electrolytes.
Sodium, potassium, chloride, and bicarbonate. A system that requires such elements as its primary nutrients.
Yeah?
Yes, especially if the system pH were high enough. The application of a normally mild acid, such as vinegar, could result in an abnormally violent reaction.
After stocking up on bottles of white vinegar, I finally got hungry enough to track down a decent breakfast at a nearby diner. I was chasing the last bit of sourdough toast down with some more coffee when the two stools on either side of me became occupied by pinstripe suits. Very large pinstripe suits. Lucchesi or Schultz?
Lucchesi, driver.
Really? What can I do for you on this fine morning?
Mr. Lucchesi wants to see you.
I got conflicting messages in steroid stereo. I responded by finishing my breakfast and then making a point of taking my time using a napkin.
Mr. Driver is insistent, Mr. Mandolin. He requires your presence immediately.
Mr. Lucchesi's needs take precedence. Mr. Mandolin, you will accompany me now.
He put a hand on my shoulder. I put the napkin down.
The last guy who tried to strong-arm me wound up explaining things to a very unsympathetic boss.
I looked at the hand.
Why is this thing still here?
The hand lifted.
It appears we have an impasse.
Indeed.
Huh. San Francisco was obviously getting a better quality of thug.
So how shall we settle this?
Occam's razor.
Entities must not be multiplied beyond necessity.
The hiring policies for henchmen must have gotten a lot stricter since the last time I looked.
I agree. Simplicity is better than complexity in these matters.
And the settlement?
Mutual participation?
Acceptable.
Fellas, really, I'm flattered. I mean, I feel like the last piece of chicken at a buffet, but I have my hands full with another case right now. Sorry, but there's no time to take on additional clients.
Stay out of this.
It was decided that neutral territory would be my office. From the looks that Driver and Lucchesi gave my 500 square feet, it had been quite a while since they'd been slumming. Lucchesi sat in the chair to my left, and Driver occupied the one on the right. Each man had a couple of oversized bodyguards in tow. I was surprised. I had no idea Armani came in triple extra large. They stood behind their respective bosses, filling the rest of the space in my somewhat snug office. Neither Lucchesi nor Driver spoke. Each man looked at me as if expecting something profound. Boy, were they going to be disappointed.
So, guys, long time no see. How's Trix?
You have rather poor survival instincts, Mr. Mandolin. I think that is why I like you.
I agree. That and his unrelenting stubbornness.
As much as I appreciate the compliments, gentlemen, my BS meter is pegged. Why are we here? The usual rate supply, by the way. I saw a faint smile lift a corner of Lucchesi's mouth. Driver glanced at his man and then nodded with the barest movement. Huh. I had an audience to play to.
You are not an altruist, Mr. Mandolin.
No, he is not, Randall, and neither are we. But he has managed to produce results whereby your police department has not.
True. And that brings us to today.
Uh-oh.
Yes. Tell us, Mr. Mandolin, what do you know about vampires?
Vampires?
Philip, acquaint Mr. Mandolin with our current level of intelligence, will you?
Philip reached into his suit coat and pulled out a small flip-top notebook.
Mr. Mandolin was observed to enter the bookstore on Geary at 1:05 p.m. He spoke for a brief period of time to one Maxwell Keebler about the existence of vampires and then had a longer conversation with a man known only as Simon. Further investigation into that individual has revealed little, except that he has been reported to be in the city since the time of the 1906 earthquake. From there, Mr. Mandolin spent a period of time exchanging information with his friend at the police department, and then ate a hamburger at a neighborhood pub. The next day, he used public transport to travel to the Park Panhandle District. There, he spotted this Simon and—
All right, enough. You've established that you consider yourselves above any perceived right to privacy. Frankly, I'd be pissed, especially if you hadn't already paid me more than my usual clientele. But, vampires?
We are not naive, Mr. Mandolin. It has long been known by those willing to look beyond the ends of their respective noses that creatures of fantasy have some basis in reality.
We are also aware of your encounter in your apartment and your eventual success.
Now, just a minute. If you've had these king-sized men's warehouse rejects following me around every waking hour of the day, why didn't you step in when I had Simon on the ropes, huh? Why didn't you put a few 12-gauge holes through him while I was chasing him through the park? What was this, an exercise in stalking? Both Driver and Lucchesi seemed suddenly more interested in cleaning the fuzz off their sleeves than in answering my question. Come on, talk!
We failed in both our attempts to exact justice, Mr. Mandolin.
What happened?
We lost two good men because of you.
Enough, Philip. One more word and you are unemployed.
I lost three men. They were overmatched.
I don't recall getting any help in the chase or in my apartment.
My men died in the forest west of Woodside.
For mine, it was in the alley around the corner from your apartment. And before you ask, the scene was cleared. I need no interference from the police.
So, what they were telling me is that Simon had shredded five bodyguards of the extra-large variety. Men like Driver and Lucchesi didn't hire wannabe MMA types. They hired the real thing. I suspected they also started at the top and worked their way down. This also meant that I had succeeded where five of their best had not. Where do we go from here?
I propose we marshal our forces and use our combined intelligence to track down this fellow and eliminate the threat.
Agreed. Mr. Mandolin, it is clear to anyone in this room that you are no match for any of the men we lost. Yet you faced the same foe and not only survived, but triumphed.
It is that facility for bullying straight in where angels fear to tread and coming out the other end comparatively whole that we find intriguing. We have avenues of information you do not, and you have an indefinable something we do not. If we put our heads together, we can win this thing.
Which brings us back to our original question, Mr. Mandolin. What do you know about vampires? Specifically, how did you win?
I broke a jar of pickles on his head. Driver and Lucchesi lost their smiles.
I'm not joking.
I went on to explain what Paul and Ignatova had discovered, and then described my fight with Simon, including the realization that I got extremely lucky and came out on top due to circumstance rather than any real prowess on my part. When I finished, both Driver and Lucchesi looked thoughtful.
Interesting.
I could tell that this alliance was going to be an uneasy one at best. Neither Lucchesi's nor Driver's men had much use for me. Apparently, uppity gumshoes were not the preferred addition to their team. A decision emerged to put together a sort of hunting party. Lucchesi and Driver's network would gather intelligence. I would do what I do, but forward on any information that came my way, and hopefully it would be useful. I didn't mention Simon's indication that he was not the only one of his kind. Some dogs from Billy, and a stroll up to Union Square cleared some of my cobwebs. The square had one of its interminable festivals going on. This one included several brightly colored booths lining the perimeter, and a number of strolling entertainers mixing with the crowds. A couple of mimes competed with each other near the western steps, and a street musician stood by one of the entrances playing some random song that sounded familiar but was just bad enough that I couldn't place it. The offerings in his guitar case showed that a lot of passersby were either tone-deaf or sympathetic. I browsed the booths, taking advantage of the atypical sunny day to escape from the stress of the last few. Most of the stuff being offered up for sale held little interest unless you were a devotee of the shopping channels. A couple had some interesting hand-thrown pottery, and one was selling some rather unique blown glass items. I thought they would do well a bit further up the northern coastline.
Can I offer you a book?
I turned to see who had spoken. The booth next to the glass items had stacks of used books. I didn't see the seller. Who's offering? I moved closer to see into the booth. I still couldn't see anyone there.
Open your eyes just a bit wider.
Huh? I put both hands on the table in front of the booth and leaned over. Nope, still saw only books.
Ah, bother. There. Can you see me now?
I had to blink a few times. Sitting on a stack of books was a little guy roughly 6 inches high with a vivid green high-collared coat and a hideously contrasting orange vest. Below that, he wore knee breeches with calf-high stockings and black shoes sporting large, for him, brass buckles. I was looking at what appeared to be a leprechaun. He even had the red hair, mutton chops, and tiny little gold-rimmed spectacles. I glanced over my shoulder to see if anyone else saw the little guy.
Don't worry, only you can see me, Biggin. Only you.
Why?
Thick as a plank, aren't you? Never mind. Have to work with what's available, I suppose. Why is because your eyes have been opened. Well, opened as far as a thick Biggin's can.
I'm seeing what looks like a leprechaun talking to me in the middle of San Francisco. For all I know, there was something other than mustard on the last hot dog.
Like I said, thick as a plank. I'm not a leprechaun, by the way. I'm a pixie. Leps are great big oafs, almost 18 inches tall. Not as big and clumsy as you giants, mind you, but big enough.
Mm-hmm. Had to be the dog. First a vampire, now pixies.
The pixie took out a pipe, far too large to be concealed anywhere on his person, and inserted the end into a corner of his mouth. Pink smoke began curling out of the bowl.
Vampire, eh? Ah, so that's how it happened. Usually you humans just wind up being dinner.
He blew a pink smoke ring at me.
What the hell is going on?
You Biggins, so many questions, so little learning. The whole of creation is all around you, and you wander through it only noticing about this much. Sad, that is. Really sad.
If all you've got for me is insults, I've got better things to do. Bye. Good luck with the fairies.
Wait!
I turned back to face the booth and found myself looking at a man. An average, normal-as-dirt man. He stood eye to eye with me, was about my same weight, but with the pixie's face and hair.
Who are you? Where's the little guy? What?
Realization started knocking on my brain's door.
Ah, he's coming around.
You grew.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, grew. Really grew.
Mm-hmm.
You're the pixie.
Got it in one. Here's the deal. You've got vampire all over you, which can mean only one thing. You were attacked and somehow survived, right?
Yeah. Wait, how'd you know? You connected to Driver or Lucchesi?
Who? Never mind. No connections. You reek of vampire, and I have an agenda.
An agenda?
Vampires. Your particular vampire likes my people as snacks.
Ah, noted. So, where do we go from here? Do you sprinkle me with pixie dust and fly me to Neverland?
It doesn't work that way, and besides...
He gave me a disgusted look.
Ah, you got me back just then, didn't you?
He grimaced again at my smile.
Not as thick as I thought.
I looked around at the crowd on the square. There had to be over a couple hundred milling around and checking out the various booths and vendors, but no one seemed interested in the book booth. For San Francisco, that was well out of character. How come...
A small magic. I'm here, but they don't care. If anyone is attracted, their attention is diverted elsewhere when they get too close.
How?
Pixie dust.
I caught the dig. Mm-hmm. Right. Good one. Guess we're even now. You're telling me that I've somehow been given the ability to see into the world of Anderson and Grimm? And that all of these people aren't going to think me talking to an empty booth isn't just a bit off?
Not empty, just uninteresting. You bring to my community a unique opportunity. Revenge.
Isn't that a rather petty reason?
Perhaps, but it's an honest one. There's several differences between the Fae and humans. One is, we don't lie. Your vampire is going to come after you. He can't do anything else. Prey isn't supposed to fight back, and prey that not only fights back and wins.
He spread his hands and smiled. You want in on this, don't you?
My people want in, not just me.
How will you...
We'll find you. One of the other differences between us is you humans smell. Well, stink, really. Ta-ta.
And with that, the pixie was gone.